You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Peggy Batya-Lowenberg. Peggy, thanks so much for being with me today.
Yes, and feel free to call me Batya.
Batya, so. Let's talk about what you're working on now, Batya. You're in Florida, is that correct? Where are you exactly?
Okay, I'm in Florida, not my natural choice, but recent familial choice to be near my wonderful aging mom. She's getting younger by the minute. So I'm in South Florida. I'm in Palm Beach County in the city of Boca Raton.
And tell me a little bit about what's happening there, because, of course, I know quite a bit about your activities, but you seem, as an artist, as you're saying, out of, you know, the territory you'd normally be in, you're very active there and thriving, it seems.
Thank you, yes, and I thank God for that. It's been a very interesting journey. I'm originally from the East Village in New York in the heyday of the 80s and in 96 for a variety of reasons, but spiritual epiphany connection. I moved to Israel and lived there for over 18 years, thought I would even live out the rest of my life there. And things changed, and I felt that it was important to be near my aging mom. And what I feel like what's exciting right now, and maybe we could talk about zeitgeist kind of stuff, is in coming back to the States, you know, almost as an expat in a way, although I'm a dual citizen, but coming back here, I see changes, good and bad, and of course, you know, we're dealing with political stuff, which we won't get into so much. But there's more of an awareness than when I left, I think, of the role of art in local economies and in the bigger economy. And there's all these studies and all these statistics, and it's new or new-ish, and it's very exciting because living an artist's life, as you know, is not easy. But all of a sudden, they're seeing that they can utilize artist talent and artist lives and, you know, opening up art districts and art walks and help towns and cities flourish. And I think that's a newer arc of understanding and accepting artists. And then we have to, you know, we bump into, you know, where is the line between it serves us too and it doesn't. You know, just in the old days when I was advocating, artists moved into Soho and established Soho as a warehouse, aging warehouse district. And then at some point they couldn't afford Soho. And they, you know, they were calling me for advocacy because their landlord was now doubling or tripling the price. But I'm getting off topic. But I think, you know, there's this new burgeoning interest in the arts and the interest in how the arts can move the economy, can move tourism, and can help towns get reinvigorated. And so along with that, there's more opportunities for artists, I think, than ever before. And, you know, percent for art with building projects, you know, opening up art districts, opening up, you know, studios run by the municipality, taking over old buildings in, you know, in rundown neighborhoods. So there's a lot happening in this area. And we're also, you know, we're connected to Miami and all of that, but we're also different than Miami. It's more suburban here, more retired people. You know, there's also poorer families. There's people of color, of all different color. There's a lot of Northerners who have come down this area. And it's also very beautiful naturally. So I'm making friends with lizards, which is new for me.
And then tell me a little bit about how you engage in that local economy, because I know from what I know about you, part of the way you're working with your work is you're able to engage some of the aspects you just spoke of in the local economy, in terms of creating public art or commissions in your own way. If I've got that right, mm-hmm. can you explain a little bit about that? Mm-hmm. How you work and engage the community with your work, which is mm-hmm. also I imagine how you survive.
Yeah. Well, there's a range of what I'm doing, and it's interesting because the most recent thing, which was a private commission is from someone that saw me at a live painting event and asked me to do a private commission based on my personal work. So sometimes my public art is more a community engagement thing where they're actually coming up with the ideas and the images, and I'm kind of the vehicle or the vessel for that, combined with my style, of course. And then there's other times, like this recent moment, where she really wanted something from me, which goes along with my more personal work. But the public artwork, let's see, I'll talk about several different things. One is that I spent 8 months working with at-risk kids, and I worked with all ages. I would say my favorite age was age 8 to 10.
And these are at-risk kids, what is the definition of at-risk?
These are kids that may come from broken homes, single-parent families, or one parent. A lot of them are immigrants from Jamaica, from Haiti, kids that the parents may be, you know, their family may be intact, but their parents are eking out, you know, minimum wage, you know. I mean, I could share that basic demographic. Like the heavier demographics is, one little girl comes to me the other day and she says, you know, this is the birthday of my brother, but he's dead now. He was in jail and he got killed in jail, and we think he was poisoned in jail, you know, and his wife has a baby and she calls her her sister. I mean, stories that you just don't want to
Right.
And one, the father got out of, you know, prison, and he's on a, there's a name for it, you know, work that he's out, but, you know, it's not parole. I forget what it is. But, you know, and some stories, you know, another one I didn't know, you know, his mother promised that they would travel to Europe, and they travel all over, and she's not in a place to do that, but this is his dream, you know.
Right.
Another one talks about her baby sister all the time, and she doesn't have a baby sister, I found out from her older brother.
So, tell me about the work that you're doing with these at-risk children.
Well, many different things, but one project that I've really loved doing with them is that we did these group paintings. And what I did was I just took big pieces of watercolor paper, and I just did like a black outline, and they sat down, 3 to 4 kids, on this big piece of paper. I think it was like, you know, 20 by 24, 22 by 24 inches, and they painted every part of that paper. And they came out as gorgeous abstracts. I taught them beforehand a little about, you know, what is abstract art. We talked about patterns and color mixing, and we learned like little, you know, how to draw little things inside the bigger patterns. And we had like 6 beautiful paintings that could be in a gallery. So,
wow.
I mean, that's like exciting. So you
continue to do that. You're working with them. You've been doing that. And I know you're working on several things, so I want to move through them all. Then you're also, sure. So you're making art with them. You're getting commissions at different times, but there's more. Yeah, go on.
Well, there's the first project I did with them was really fabulous. I just forgot about that. And so we did, the kids are still pretty small, and so we got rolls of canvas, and we worked in groups of 3. And we talked about jumping and flying and dancing and different poses. And then we would choose one kid to outline, and we would outline him or her in a pose on the canvas. And then we would draw it in. And they were group projects. And so we learned about, about color, and we learned about patterns, and we learned about all different things. And then we hung them up at the club where the after-school club where I was working with them. And that was, so they're like life-size group portraits of them jumping and dabbing and hip-hopping and really, really wonderful. I could
wonderful.
Show you pictures sometime. Yeah, and the kids just come alive. I mean, they just,
They love art. They would not condemn the doors to the art.
And then tell me, so before, I want to go back into your history a little bit,
sure,
with some of the first projects you've done, but to say one more thing about the work that you're doing now, there are commissions, mm-hmm, and are there also other public art things that you're doing now that are beyond the typical one-on-one commissions that you've spoken of, as well as workshops?
Well, right now I am still waiting to hear. I'm a finalist for two projects. There's a lot of building down here, so if anyone wants to come down and do construction, they're always building new things. So there's a town nearby where they're building a new city hall with their main public library branch. And I'm a finalist for a very large painting there. And they're still meeting with committees. It's been months. So I'm waiting on that. And the other is a smaller thing, but it's designing traffic boxes. So they're bringing art into the public realm. And we did that. I did that for two summers in the city of West Palm Beach also. And they brought, like, with other artists, and it brought in like 10,000 visitors in the summer in Florida, which is unbearable. 10,000 visitors, you know.
Wow.
And they had music and they had other things, and there was something, you know, it's a careful walk, but there was a respect for what we bring to the table as artists. So you know, even as alienated and as alien as we feel in our culture at times, there is somewhat of an open door appreciation. And also on our side, and you're someone who helps with that, we also need to advocate and make sure that we get paid well, that the contracts are fair to us, et cetera, et cetera. But the excitement of that, what we have to offer can, you know, can draw families of every stripe, can draw officials of every stripe. It's something exciting and new, I think, that's happening, and I think it's happening across the country more and more.
I think so too. And speaking of artist advocacy, I'd like to go back to early projects of yours, because you've been an artist advocate for so long. The Artist Hotline, can you tell me a little bit about what that is and how it started and your involvement there?
Sure. It's kind of a funny story. Okay, so, you know, I was a starving, passionate artist in the East Village in the 80s. And out of the 70s, when artists were, you know, really seeing themselves as cultural workers, and it was, you know, a time of just standing up and demanding rights. So there was an organization, or a coalition of artists, that was fighting for artists' rights, and they started something called the Foundation for the Community of Artists. So they went from being a loose-knit coalition to actually becoming a nonprofit. And it was artist-run, and they had health insurance, they had newsletters, they had all sorts of things. And at that time, they also had, a job placement service called Artwork. And so I went in. I was actually doing some theater design, theater sets, and carpentry, and doing a bunch of stuff to make ends meet. And in those days, I mean, I'm a little older than you, but in those days, you could get a storefront or an apartment for like $100 a month, you know. So, but it still wasn't easy. But anyway, so I trooped in there and sat with them, and we went through all these different jobs, and there wasn't anything that really applied to me at that moment. But I just kept sitting there talking to the people running the place. And then in came the director, and we started talking, and he said, you know, the census is coming up soon. We really want artists to be counted in the census so they really know what's going on and that we should be counted literally and figuratively. And we have a potential grant sitting with the council, I think it was called the Community Council of Greater New York. And we haven't found a person yet to head this up. Would you be interested? I said, you've got to be kidding. Of course I'd be interested. So what it was is that it was through federal monies at the time. I think Carter was the president. And there was also a CETA artist program like the WPA back in the 30s and 40s. But this was related to community services. And I was the only artist involved with this. What they were doing is they were giving funding to geographic communities throughout New York City. And then there was the artist community, which was the art community at large. I mean, I don't know how many artists there were in New York at the time, probably 100,000, something like this. I don't know. I don't remember. To start information and referral services to help their community, to take phone calls, to give advice, to refer them, you know, for food stamps, for, you know, legal help, for all sorts of help. And so I went to these meetings and we started it from scratch. We started an artist hotline at the Foundation for the Community of Artists. We got an extra phone, an extra office space for me. You know, I did it for 1 to 2 years. That's all the funding was for. I got interns, actually. I had assistants working for me for free.
And so tell me a little bit about exactly what the hotline did, though. So you had interns there, you had finances to keep the lines open, and what was the hotline for? What could artists call and ask, or anyone?
Anything or everything. So everything from I'm being thrown out of my loft in Tribeca, what do I do, to, you know, I'm doing some prints, I'm doing some illustrations, I need to know about contracts, to I don't know how to deal with my life and my career and balancing things. So
those were a lot of questions, right? That's very important, and those were a lot of questions. You obviously know a lot of that, but you were training people to also answer all those questions, right? It's a lot of different information,
right. Really. Right. So what I was doing, I was gathering what organizations do what. So social service organizations, art-related organizations, and we started putting together a list, and in those days, a Rolodex. This is like, I think it was even pre-computers in those days, if I'm correct. Yeah, it was like 80, 81. So, you know, we got to know about volunteer lawyers for the arts. We got to know about health hazards for artists. There's actually like a sub OSHA thing with health hazards for artists. You know, the Lower Manhattan, I think it was Lost Tenants. They were doing a lot of advocacy and helping artists in Lost. So, you know, I got to know a lot of the different people that were helping artists and just helping human beings, helping residents of the city. And so we would gather together these lists and we would learn who to talk to and how to, you know, how to help artists connect with them. Sometimes the artist would walk in or set up an appointment, and we would advise them. So it was everything from career questions to basic social service issues to legal questions, business questions.
It's such a fantastic resource. That's you know, I just love that, and it seems like such a fantastic type of advocacy, because I don't think there's anything quite like that now.
Yeah, it would be a good thing. It would certainly be
because
a good thing.
This was a service that eventually ended, right? Because the funding dried up. Right. How long did that go on for?
My memory isn't great, but I think it was between a year and 2 years. At that time, we would get small grants here and there. At that time, what I saw as the biggest issue, which wasn't really, you know, my heart, but I went on to do something else from there, which was a coaching for artists, but was the housing issue. And so I had heard, I don't even remember how this happened, but I was in touch with the city, departments of housing, and I had heard that there was some kind of community grant application, you know, like a call going out for needs. And so what I did is that I put together, similar to what we were doing, but an artist housing hotline. So I put together a grant to get an artist housing hotline and to have somebody run that. And so consequently, we got that grant, and Jimmy Durham actually got hired to do that. And I left to start the Artist Career Planning Service, which was one of the few career planning services at the time. You know, a forerunner of the amazing
Must have been one of the very first. It must have been one of the very first.
Yeah, there was Carol Michaels doing that, and I was in touch with her, and part of what I wanted to do was to get the nonprofit to take this more seriously, career planning and helping artists in a whole person, in a holistic way, you know, because artists need help, you know, with all aspects and juggling their lives. And now there's even an awareness of artists, you know, of artists who have families, artists who are mothers and fathers, you know, in those days, forget it, there was hardly any awareness of that, you know. There's even art shows of artists who are mothers and stuff. But, just lost my train of thought, sorry.
So that was the service, it was a new resource, a new service that was helping artists is what you were discussing, and how that was the next step, essentially.
Right. And also we were publishing a newsletter of opportunities and services for artists and delivering them to the local galleries and alternative spaces. There was another group at FCA, we call it Foundation for the Community of Artists, that were doing projects, I don't remember exactly what, but they were doing great projects for women and artists of color. And then their project folded. They were doing this thing called Artist Update, and their project folded. And I looked around and I said, we've got to continue the Artist Update. So we continued that also. And so that was given out free, you know, with just dozens of opportunities for artists that we would deliver all around town. And so then after that, the artist housing hotline started. I'm sure he got other calls too, but the artist hotline as it was while I was running it was no more at that point. But the artist hotline started. The artist housing hotline started. And then I went on to, you know, to start the Artist Career Planning Service. And there was the Center for Arts Information down on Broadway. I was in touch with Ted Berger, who is at the New York Foundation for the Arts. And I taught through NYU. I was teaching something called Being an Artist Means Business, career planning, so whole person career planning tools, but, you know, also focusing on marketing and all that stuff. And I didn't want to duplicate what was being done. Like, there was a guy in those days who took over from Betty Parsons.
Gallery?
Maybe. Yeah, it was in the gallery. Art Conchalar, Dan Conchalar. So he was running something called the Art Information Center, and he loved going to openings. I'm more of an introvert, but he would go to all the openings. He could keep track of all the galleries, and he would look at artists' slides in those days, and he would give them advice and a list of the galleries that he thought would be appropriate for their work, which is also phenomenal. And I don't even know how he survived, because I don't even think he was getting paid for it. And it was a nonprofit, it was an amazing generosity of heart for Dan. We worked together. And so when I worked with artists, I would, you know, part of what I did is I would send them to him. And then we would work with that list, and we'd work with their portfolio, and we'd work on their resume, and we'd also deal with, you know, job income stuff, and, you know, how to talk to people about your work, and a whole range of things. We put on a few shows together with my own artist clients. We had a support group where we also shared artwork and supported each other. So it was, you know, I worked one-on-one, and then I taught the classes at NYU, and I gave lectures at different arts councils. Wow, I'm feeling old.
That's okay. So this is all throughout the 80s. Is that correct, or did this go into the 90s?
Yeah, well, the Artist Career Planning Service kept going. So I opened that in 83, and I did that really till 96 when I moved to Israel. So I was doing it all that time. And then at one point when the new school took over Parsons School of Design, I gave some classes there also. yeah, all, you know, in their continuing ed department. But it was also a time of, and it's still going on, and hopefully you get more gigs talking at, you know, at graduate programs and undergraduate, where they didn't talk business. You know, business is a dirty word. There was, you know, kind of a different kind of elitism going on where, you know, they never talked about business in the art schools. Now, they started to, and actually, this really dates me, but I can name drop a little. You know Fred Wilson?
Sure.
Anyway, so Fred Wilson and I were both at SUNY at Purchase at the same time. And
you went to SUNY Purchase. You attended SUNY Purchase then?
Yeah, I transferred from Cornell to SUNY Purchase. I actually majored in anthropology there, not in art. But I took art classes, and I did my whole thesis and on the feminist art movement and as an artist anthropologist. So then I went out to L.A., the women's building there that Judy Chicago started. She left, but Arlene Raven and other women were there. She was an amazing art critic, really inventing new ways of looking at art, you know. But anyway, so at the time, Fred was doing some business of art with a nonprofit gallery school just above Midtown. And then we collaborated, and we both went back to Purchase and gave lectures there together. It was a one-time thing, but I remember that. And it was just really wonderful to do this with him and to go back to both our alma mater, you know. So there's story of our young days. Yeah.
And so that was, of course, a precursor to all of this, because in a way, organizations that were still thinking ahead of the time. I mean, there's many schools, including SVA, that I gave a lecture at recently, mm-hmm. where the head of the program told me, Brainerd, this school is about the conversation, not the market. You know, and you know, they asked me to do it. I think a show as interviews as social a lecture on interviews as social practice. But he was mm-hmm. even talking about what you just mentioned there, this notion of we're not going to talk about career at all here. We're only going right. to talk about the quote-unquote conversation. So that, right. that seems to still persist. And but when you were, you know, at the forefront of all of that, and then you left to Israel, by the time you came back, what had happened? There were other organizations that then began to pick up the ball, or let's say within the last 10 years, because NYFA, which you mentioned earlier, began to slowly incorporate a lot of that into its program,
right.
didn't they?
Right, yeah. Yeah, they started to more and more. And even NISCA was doing some things, you know, at the state level and the Department of Cultural Affairs. I think I gave a lecture there, was on a panel at the Department of Cultural Affairs. It was starting. But one point that I want to make, and you know, we really don't have time for this, but I think the best efforts come from artists themselves. And you are an artist, and you and your wife are artists. I mean, because we know what artists need, we know the language, even now. And this is another thing. I mean, this is a whole other conversation, but even now sometimes when there's business of art courses, you read the description and you start thinking, they don't get us. They just don't get artists, you know. I mean, and you know when someone does get you or when it's run by artists or artists that wear several hats, you know, even someone that's running a new art, well, she's not anymore, but she helped to start a new art space here, which I respect a lot, and I'm affiliated with the Arts Warehouse in Delray Beach. But anyway, so we had a discussion. She's not there anymore, and she's the director, and she came from an arts background, and she's saying artists are like any other business person. They're like any other small business. And I said yes and no.
Right.
You know, and I could go into that more, but the answer is yes and no.
Which is why artist-run initiatives, as you're saying, have a perspective that none other
right.
do. As in with right. the early ones that you were talking, I mean, NYFA isn't quite artist-run now, but there's certainly a lot of artist teachers within there, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're putting together resources, and they're putting together you know, updates, you know, on, you know, deadlines for things, even studio exchanges and studio things, you know, and some of it works nationally too. Some of it is for, you know, artists in the New York area. So, you know, and they've always been good at that. And in fact, I think my brother-in-law got a grant that was co-sponsored by them and the Department of Cultural Affairs. My sister and brother-in-law, by the way, they're jazz poets, and they live not far from where you are. They live on 145th.
Huh.
So
this is great. It's great talking to you about all this, and especially the importance of kind of advocacy. And in to just step back, so, you know, you've had all the experience with advocacy. Now you're in Florida. You're taking care of your being near family and taking care of them. And it sounds like the tools that you've taught and experienced as being an artist all these years, you're using now in terms of commissions and grants to support yourself. Mm-hmm. Is that the case?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's really been an exciting time. And also, you know, I feel like, you know, I have my coach's head on, but I'm learning how to deal with municipalities and government officials, which is also a challenge. They don't get artists all the time. I would like to, you know, see more artists on councils and on boards helping with different things. But, yeah, I think that we have a voice, and the other thing I'm finding is that groups of artists supporting each other. You know, like there's a group of us, and we send each other opportunities by email. It's not an official group, but we're willing to share resources, you know. So, but, yeah, I think that, you know, a whole other thing also from living in Israel and working among Jewish people and Arab people, and I'm also a Jewish Christian working among Christians as well, that, you know, I'm the anthropologist side of me is very into, you know, what does indigenous mean? And in Florida, which is very manicured down here, and I'm used to more of an urban environment and not even having to get in the car. Now I have to do that. But it's beautiful down here. But it has drawn me also into this, and I haven't found that bridge yet, but I'm doing a lot of studying into, you know, who's been here first. And so there are black families that started Delray Beach, which is like one of the hottest spots around here. And some of that history is obscured. There is a history of a black history museum called Spady Museum in Delray. And also learning about the indigenous tribes and peoples here and how some of the tribes merged and what's going on with them. And I also see also now coming back that a lot of Native Americans are beginning to stand up and be counted. They're even demanding a place in Congress, which was promised them in the past. Mm. So the work that I'm doing now is, you know, getting back to just a very aesthetic perspective. It's sort of aesthetic plus, which is that I'm mainly an abstract painter, and process is very important to me. And, you know, and what can one's language be today when abstract art's been going on for, you know, probably like 100 years now, Kandinsky and, you know, abstract expressionists, of course. But I'm so verbal, but that's my nonverbal place. It's a place of worship. It's a place of communication and communion. And it's also a place of community. And so as an abstract artist, I'm very, you know, interested in the mark making and the in the moment process. And at the same time, I get obsessed with different things and different bodies of my work. There was, you know, one body of my work I was very obsessed with spheres, and a very close friend and family had died, and I found myself just painting spheres and spheres connected to spheres, and, you know, and also the drawn and the painted. And that's kind of, I think, also the we're in this sort of, especially down here, this street art, wild, you know, post-graffiti time down here, but it's still very vibrant. And so municipalities are asking for murals, and we did up in Martin County, we did live murals for the day, and that was real fun. Like, we each got 8x8 foot plywood to paint on, and now they're doing a tour of our murals. And with my mural, I had people, it was actually called One Love, and it was about diversity and unity. And so I did these coils and these spirals, taking five different skin tones that they've, anyway, there was this research from different scientists about all the universal skin tones. And so right. I did sort of this whole painting of coils and what's the word? Spirals. There's a word that I'm missing right now. And then I had, in the middle of it, I realized I want people to help me with this. I didn't plan it to be interactive to begin with, but I thought, wouldn't it be nice if people chose what skin color they wanted or what skin color they were, and they painted in these parts of the foil. So we started doing that, and that was really fun. And the best was, like, there was this blended family. He's black and she's white, and the kids are a combo, and they just had fun. And the kids are like, Mommy, can I paint? So, you know, when I've done some of these live murals, it spurred me on to this project that I'm focusing on now. So the body of work that I've been doing on my own, both small and large, has been this abstract work where I started from a formalist place of, you know, how would a grid relate to, you know, to an abstract surface? What would it do to it? And so I explored that in many ways, and that evolved actually into a kind of lattice ladder image. And you always have to be careful that you don't get too literal with that, all that kind of thing. But I've really been enjoying that, you know, that angularity with the abstraction and the push-pull of the surface with that, as well as, you know, what kind of atmosphere does this throw off. And so I've been doing that, and people have been really enjoying these ladders, and they each had their own interpretations. And I thought, you know, ladder can be a potent symbol, you know. It's both very spiritual, and it can be also very material. And, you know, what would it be like for me to offer that, like, as an offering to various specific communities, and what would they do with it? How would they relate to it? How would they? And so what's evolving for me is that I want to do these live painting party concept events where I'm doing my ladders, like I did at the Arts Warehouse. And, you know, of course, we would all meet before, but, you know, a group chosen from the group that I'm meeting with to discuss what does it mean to them so that they can freely appropriate this this image or this symbol, and how does it speak to their community, and what would they want to say about it. So they would be also using the ladder and painting next to me as a group, and then we would show together. So this is what I'm on the cusp on now. And you know, and also, you know, art should never be too literal. You know, and so along with that, that they should be free to be abstract, to do graffiti, to add their names, to tag, you know. So I'm excited about that.
That is exciting. That's an exciting project.
Thanks.
Let me ask one more question before we go. Sure. I'm always curious what everyone's reading. Are you reading anything in particular at the moment that you want to share?
I prepared for that. But it's so different than other people, so it's kind of funny. I'm not generally a fiction reader. Life is too exciting. I read sections of books. Like, I have towers of books in my bedroom and also in my studio, and I'm more of a section of book reader. So I'm going to tell you some of my diverse reading material.
Okay.
And one thing you won't believe, but I read children's joke books a lot. So that's something I refer back to, and I also rate the jokes. So that's one thing that I read. I also read two devotionals that are very different, daily devotionals based on the Bible, and they're both very, very different from each other, but it's a nice combination for me. And I do read the Bible. And some other books that I read, which are very diverse, and one of them I really want to tout because I think it's very obscure but very important, is a book called The Slave Community, Plantation Life in the Antebellum South. And it's by a black historian from the 70s. His last name is Blasingame, Blasingame. And he did a lot of research, and he put together firsthand accounts of enslaved people in this book, statistics and firsthand accounts. And, you know, I think our citizens that have been enslaved, it's to hear from the first person as the subject and not as the object.
Right.
And anyway, I feel like that book is a treasure, you know, and it's something very close to my heart. Not easy reading, but I think very important reading. Another book related to that, and I feel like I'm on a soapbox now, but I don't mean to be, but I'll give you some diversity here. The other is by Michael Eric Dyson, and he's writing a sermon to white America called Tears We Cannot Stop. And he's a very light-skinned African-American, but his dad was very dark-skinned, and he saw racism firsthand because of the color of his father's skin, and also, his paradoxical life as being African-American, but also being light-skinned and being treated different, even within his family. And I can talk about Kanye West, too, so we could get excited about that. So he's been doing these amazing, cutting-edge worship concerts now that I think trumps Robert Wilson, Meredith Monk, Phil Glass. He's crossing genres like I have never seen. I think he's a genius, and he's bringing races together. He's bringing pop culture and quote-unquote high-culture performance art together. He's bringing dance, poetry, music, and preaching together. And he's getting out of the way. He's not, like, in the middle of it all. He's letting, like, the 100, 200 people that are working with him and the small collective he works with. So I encourage people to check out Kanye West's work, his new album, and he's coming out with another one. He's also coming out with an opera soon. I'm very mixed about his politics and all that, and he has a fragile soul. He's dealt with some mental illness, but he's brilliant and worth watching.
He's a great artist advocate. He just paid for, I think, like an entire 70mm presentation by James Turrell of Roden Crater. Big supporter of the arts. Yeah. Interestingly enough. Well, Bhatia, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's been a pleasure to hear not just about your art advocacy of the past, but also of your current work. Thank you so much, Bhatia.
Thank you, Brainerd. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.